The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and here we go. Again, it's Wednesday. What day is it? It's the 25th of June. Monday's the last day of June. Goodbye, June. I don't know where it went. We're going to have some fun and interesting conversation with program tonight all the way through. Hope you'll stay with us. We're going to learn some things. Coming up later on in hour three tonight, we're going to teach you how to protect yourself and mitigate the effects of electromagnetic fields and all sorts of problems from cell phone towers. If you saw the story today at Rents, 500,000 cell phone towers and masts around the U.S., cancer rates are going up faster and faster and faster. And I would only urge all of you who use cell phones, please get the earpiece and get the safe one. Don't hold those things up to your head. There was an old joke, not a funny joke, a black humor joke about a neurosurgeon who operated on people's brains, tumors, and people would come into his office, and if they were diagnosed with a tumor, he would tell them which side of their head they held their cell phone on. And he said he was never wrong. And people say, well, how did you know? We don't get the truth from this technology. And it's very sad to see young people pressing these things against their heads. And I've told you the story about one of the latest rages now among teens and tweens whose parents are so stupid that they buy them these deadly machines. They go to bed with them at night, conference call about 8 or 10 of their friends, so they have a big daisy chain, and they stay on all night. And they doze off, and they wake up, and they mumble and talk to each other, and go back to sleep. So all night long, they're bathing their still growing and developing brains in deadly electromagnetic radiation. It's nuts. We're going to find out later on tonight, again, how to minimize and mitigate much of that, so stay tuned for that. First up tonight is my friend and colleague of many years, George Filer, one of the truly nice, great men in the field of ufology. He's a gentleman's gentleman, always in his monthly visits, presents interesting material, and is the editor-in-chief of Filer's Files, which comes out every week, and you can get a free subscription just by asking. Just write to George at Major, M-A-J-O-R, star, at Verizon.net and ask, and you will receive. Frank Chile, who we've come to know, is a very interesting man who has had a number of experiences himself with strange machinery flying around up there and down here. Frank is back tonight. And Frank recently introduced us to a young lady named Judy Beebe, who is going to be on in a few minutes to tell us about something that she feels came to her from the ghost of Nikola Tesla. Now, let's not laugh out loud. Let's hear Judy out. She started to tell the story last time. We ran out of time, and I invited her back tonight with George and Frank to hear the rest of it. So we will do that in just a few minutes. Hello, Mr. Feiler. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. A beautiful day in New Jersey, 90 degrees, and sun shining.
90?
Right. Kind of warm.
How far are you from gambling?
Oh, about 45 minutes. I used to have a TV show in Atlantic City for a couple of years about this same subject.
Yeah, funniest thing. You've been in a rut since the 1950s when you
right.
saw them. George, Major Feiler was in the United States Air Force and visually saw and on radar saw unidentified flying objects and chased them. And what were you flying at the time? You were up on board what kind of a craft?
Well, it was a tanker aircraft,
mm-hmm.
tactical air command tanker called a KB-50J. And I don't know if you want me to tell the story, but it was over England.
Yeah, please. I like to hear it.
That we had finished our refueling mission just as the sun set, and London Control called and said they had an unidentified object. Would we be willing to chase it? And we said, sure.
London Control, George, was this military?
Well, it's both military and civilian.
Okay.
And they they pretty much control all of England and the UK, you know, keep things going straight. In any case, they gave us a clear heading down towards Stonehenge and England. We were up over the North Sea, so it was about 100 miles to go over the center of England. And you're probably aware that there's a lot of sightings around Stonehenge. In any case, we were at like 33,000 feet. We had to let down to about 3,000 feet, and we're going fast as the aircraft could go. As a matter of fact, we went too fast and we're going past the red line and had to slow down so the wings didn't fall off.
The adrenaline got hold of the pilot. He got right. a heavy foot. That's exciting.
I think that happens more often than people
well,
realize.
We've lost air crew and planes. Were you down on the deck or over the water?
Well, at the time, we were over the water when they asked us to intercept, but when we were over England as we descended and headed straight for the UFO. And we got our radar going, and off in the distance, we could see this huge UFO. Now, I don't know if people are familiar with radar, but...
This is daytime, right? Or is this
no,
nighttime?
This is nighttime.
Okay.
But our standard... bridge that we always picked up on the radar because you could pick up almost 200 miles away was the Firth of Forth Bridge in Scotland, which is about a mile long. It's kind of like the Brooklyn Bridge or the San Francisco Bay Bridge, you know, in other words, a huge bridge. And it makes a beautiful radar return. Well, as we turned on the radar, here's what is equivalent to the Scotland Bridge right in front of us. In other words, the UFO's radar return was very similar to the bridge,
huh.
which would indicate it was quite large and quite substantial.
Yeah.
And as we descended further...
could you see lights, George? Was it lit?
Well, as we got closer, I would say 5 miles away or so, we saw lights that looked something like a ship at sea, you know, where you uh-huh. see the lights on the ship, but you can't really tell what kind of a ship it is. But
you couldn't see the people on the promenade deck, in other words.
No. Mm-hmm. Any case, we saw way off in the distance as we got, I don't know, 3 miles or so from it, and it just went up into space. And But London Control had it on the radar. We had it on radar, and we saw it visually. And off it went. We were doing about over 400, and I would say it was doing 10 times faster than we did, going
when
up into space.
When it accelerated, it just gone.
Right. A huge vehicle. Interesting that the Air Force didn't seem to think too much about it when we told them when we went back. But about a week later, we had a dining in at the officers' club, and that's where all the officers get together, and the speaker was Prince Philip, the Queen's husband.
Pretty amazing, yeah.
And he gave a nice talk, and then he said he'd like to talk and have dessert with the crew that chased the UFO last week over Oxford. So he, or Stonehenge area, that he knew all about it and was quite interested, and we sat down and had dessert with him and a couple of cigars, and he was very friendly and very into UFOs, considered them to be, real, had no doubt in his mind, really convinced me completely that they were real and that high levels of the government knew all about them.
This is
so I asked him why he was interested.
Yeah.
And he said that his uncle, Earl Mountbatten, who had raised him, had seen them up close, and that obviously he believed his uncle, and he had been the viceroy for India, and it indicated that he probably saw it in India, where a lot of UFOs are seen.
Lord Mountbatten, one of the really great figures of the last century, and not known by most people, kind of in the murky edges of mainstream history. Fascinating life, and we're going to go through this break, Todd. Thank you. Thanks. I don't like to hear my voice. Okay. That's a remarkable story, George. A little bit more about Prince Philip. He told you that Lord Mountbatten had told him that these are quite real and they're quite here.
Right.
What was his demeanor about it? Interested, fascinating to him, a little concerned?
He indicated that he tried to interview all the air crews, or, you know, people that had good sightings, we would call them, and that either he or his aides would interview the, the air crews, both English and American, that had seen UFOs, and he was quite interested in them and felt that, we should study them and find out what they're doing. And so many words, are they friends or foe or both, or, just what are they? It wasn't any question in his mind that I could pick up that UFOs
right.
were not real.
Right.
Like I believe in them, and I think you believe in them, and a lot of our listeners probably believe in them.
Well, it really isn't a question of a belief system any more than it's a question on, I believe that the Sierra Nevada mountains are there, or that Medford, New Jersey exists. It is. And so when we use that expression, we always do so advisedly. Now, Major Filer went on, just so you folks know, to attain top secret security clearance and gave briefings to the brass. On lots of different things. Tell us a little bit about that, George, too. That's always interesting.
Right. Well, I had been at Tactical Air Command headquarters at Langley Air Force Base, and General Dissisway was the commander at that time. This is back in 1962 when the Cuban Missile Crisis was going on.
Yeah.
And having been in, sounds funny, in England, and part of the war plan, I had obtained very high clearances, and they looked around for a courier, and they found that, I had this high clearance, so they grabbed me, and I went in to see General Dissisway, and he had film from Cuba, over Cuba, that our planes had taken. Some at low level and some at high level, showing the Russian missiles and so on. And he wanted me to take them to General LeMay's office in the Pentagon. And I became a courier, and I was going back and forth between General LeMay and General Dissuade. And sounds funny, but rather than picking up the phone and talking to each other and afraid that, the enemy may be intercepting our phone calls or something, I was carrying messages back and forth. And one of the messages that I was given was from General LeMay is that if they shoot down one of our fighters or our reconnaissance aircraft, we're going to go in and take out, well, say it was a fighter base, we would take out the fighter base. If it was the SAM site, we would take out the SAM site. And he wanted me to make sure that our aircraft and so on were ready. And there was, frankly, hundreds of them ready to go and strike Cuba at the time. And sure enough, RF-101 was shot down. And
we lost a U-2.
And a U-2. And we lost, in any case, we were ready to go in. And the president
said no.
Kennedy said no.
LeMay was fit to be tied. He was enraged.
And LeMay was very upset. And I was in his office when he was upset on occasion.
That's
I'll tell
amazing.
You one interesting fact is he had the most beautiful secretaries that I'd ever seen in the Air Force. Yeah. I guess if you're a four-star general, you can afford to have beautiful secretaries.
Yeah, it's the accoutrements of the office, I guess. Yeah, that's, well, you're a rock star. He was a rock star in the Air Force, so you get that kind of stuff.
Well, in any case, the rest of my career, I ended up briefing generals every morning, kind of like your local news reports, although some of it would be secret or top secret, whatever.
Right.
And
well, that's always fascinating to help our listeners understand who Major Filer was and is and why he is such an important figure in the effort to bring this information, whatever it is, to all of us for our honest consideration and evaluation. We have a birthright to know this stuff, and the idea that the cover-up continues is quite offensive, really. But
and
we know,
I will
know
say this, that all the generals that I knew that they were out there.
Well,
I never had,
sure.
You know, like snickering or anything like that. It was very serious when you would make a report that, you know, a C-5 crew was flying in formation with a disc or something like that. I mean, they took it all very seriously.
Always. Now, Frank Chile is standing by. Frank, how'd you get mixed up with this guy, George Filer?
Go through the Trenton UFO study group. And would see George at Patty Blackwell's parties at her home and her gatherings, and we connected and had a lot to share. And it's just a joy knowing George. It really is. He's an elder statesman and like an elder brother for us. He really is.
He's a remarkable man. And no more compliments, George. That's it.
Thank you for all your.
I'm always learning
nice
from him, Jeff. As long as I've known him, I'm always learning something new when I talk with him.
Yeah, he is. I could say much the same thing. There is so much that he holds back because he's not on an ego trip. And every time he talks, now I didn't know that he had spent that much time with LeMay and LeMay's office. That's fascinating. And LeMay was a cigar-chomping top Air Force general in World War II and is said to have known it all. There was nothing he didn't know. So fascinating man and a larger-than-life character. And those days were pretty wild, I guess. So, Frank, your contribution to this field, we've talked about in length, some length with you, about some of the things you've seen, amazing things, and people can hear in the archives your prior visits, previous to this one, in which you describe what you've seen. Is there anything you haven't talked about that you want to put on the table here tonight?
Oh, my gosh, I've been privileged to meet some contactees who've had interaction with the visitors that look like us probably since the late 60s. And
the
some
tall,
of these
the tall blondes,
been,
or are these more just like us?
Just like us. They look just like us.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the stories have been published, and some of them have not. And some of them are really little-known contactees. And one goes back to 1920, which I consider to have been the grandfather of UFO contactees. And some night I'll share that story with your audience. But I think tonight I believe that you and your audience will be very informed by what Judy has to share. And I would only make one suggestion or request, Jeff, ask her what it was like to look deeply into Valiant Thor's eyes.
Okay, I'll do that. Judy, what was it like to look deeply into Valiant Thor's eyes? And what were the circumstances of this? Was this that first time you saw him when you were 17 at a party of some kind, and he turned around? You were looking at his back, and he turned around and looked at you without you saying anything and walked up to you. Was that the story? It's your turn, Judy.
Yeah, he did. He walked up to me and held my hand and told me I lived there, meaning on Venus. And I never thought about it, but when Frank asked me what color was his eyes, I thought, there was no color. And so I flashed back, and I realized that there was no end to his eyes. It was like you could fall in there and you were in a big well. I mean, there was just, I can remember that now. I didn't remember it until Frank brought it up. I was too busy looking at how handsome he was.
Well, that's what everyone who saw him, male and female, said. He was this remarkably perfect-looking male. And I'm wondering if he ever said anything to Frank Stranges or anyone else, Frank Chile, about the others on Venus. Did they all look like they were perfect? Did they have that kind of look? Or was he just unique? Did they look different and he happened to be looking a little more slicker than the average Venusian?
Jeff, I could answer this, that the photograph that was taken behind Howard Menger's home in 1957 at High Bridge, that color photograph, there was Valiant Thor, his brother Don Thor, which spelled D-O-N-N, and a space woman by the name of Jill, who was a tall, blonde-looking girl. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Strange said that whenever he would have an opportunity to go on board Victor 1 and meet some of the other visitors from Venus, he said they all look like us.
Well, they could pass, and they do pass, and they are passing us on the sidewalks and apparently on the roadways, and they're deeply involved with this failing species of ours, and perhaps they will be able to do something at some point in time to turn this sinking ship around. I would hope so. All right, stand by. We'll come right back with our special guest, Judy Beebe, and Frank Chile, and Major George Filer. Hang on, gang. We'll be right back. Talking to George and Frank, and it's Judy Beebe's turn. Now, Judy, when did your life become strange? Was it strange before you saw Valiant? No. Was it strange before that 17-year-old girl met Valiant Thor?
Yeah. It's always been strange. Now, keep in mind, I was born in 1939. You didn't talk about reincarnation. You didn't talk about the things that were everyday things in my life. Mm-hmm. And about the age of three or four, each morning when I would wake up, this voice right before I would become fully awake would say, "Awaken, sweet spirit."
A nice way
that
to wake up every
normal
day. Yeah. Did you? When was the first time you recall hearing the name Edgar Cayce?
Oh, I'd always known about him. Dr. Mack used to talk about him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I remember the first time for me was in college when I read Jess Stern's book, Edgar Cayce, The Sleeping Prophet.
Yeah, and The Sleeping Prophet. That was the first one I read.
Yeah. Well, you were alive when he was still reading. I think he gave readings until 1944 when he died. And he basically died because he gave so many readings. There's an old saying, you're supposed to sing off the interest, not the capital investment. And he gave so much. He was giving from his capital investment, and he burned himself out and did die younger than he should have. But he was doing this when you were alive, and there were others. Now, you had a feeling, I guess, as a teenager when you met Valiant Thor, that this was a very complicated and very diverse universe and solar system. What happened to you after that? Did you see him again? Did you want to see him again? What was the situation?
No, I never saw him again, because not too long after that... Well, first of all, I was a young, got married and had babies, and so I didn't go down to Dr. Max as often as I used to. And the next thing I knew was the Otis Carr thing, where they took away his spaceship and confiscated everything, and then they did that with my guru or Dr. Mack. They came in and took out all of her radionics equipment, and so that all she had left was just doing chiropractic adjustments. And but the interesting thing was, we were really worried about her, and so we went running down there, and she said, "Not to worry. They took me out. I wasn't even in my body when they arrested me."
Hmm. Well,
so it was kind of cute.
Yeah, that was the lady, the radionics lady, and how did you meet her, and ultimately what happened?
Well, when I was 3 years old, I was in a diabetic coma.
Mm-hmm.
And on my maternal side, it was riddled with diabetes. I mean, my aunt, my mother had a slight case of diabetes, which was healed later as well. Everybody in the family was healed except my grandfather, who had really severe diabetes, and in fact gave himself injections 2-3 times a day of insulin.
Uh-huh.
And I can remember still watching him do that when I was little, and how he would grimace when he would inject himself, you know.
Sure.
So when he found out that I was as bad as I was, he said, "Don't take her to the doctor. I've heard about Dr. Margaret McKinnon here in Turlock, and she's doing some amazing work. Take her to Dr. Mack." And so that's what she did. And I walked out of there. I was completely out of it, I guess, my mother said. I mean, I was not even conscious. And I walked out of there smiling and skipping, I guess. So that's how she came into our life. And then I was treated until I was 13. So for 10 years, I was under her tutelage, which included UFO tutelage and all kinds of metaphysical stuff. So not your normal childhood at that time in history.
Did you see UFOs as a child or as an adult early on?
Yep.
When did this start for you?
And I have my whole life. I uh-huh. see them now. They're outside of my house.
Up in the air, or they come down low?
No, they're up in the air, and at most of the time they disguise themselves as a star, you know, mm-hmm. that's hanging out. See, I live on a mountaintop and look out over Flathead Lake, which is a huge freshwater
where,
lake.
Where is that lake? What state is that in?
Montana.
That's right.
Montana.
That's right.
Yeah. And over the Swan Mountains, which are the top end of the Rocky Mountains. So it's beautiful. And my grandson was over one night, and I said, "Osti, do you see that star out there?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "What do you think?" And he said, "I don't know. What is it, Grandma?" I said, "Get the binoculars." And when he put the binoculars up to his eyes, he went, "Holy cow, Grandma!" Because you can see the lights going around, you know, and a circle. And
sure.
Stars don't do that.
Okay, now, we did talk last time about the three Georges.
Yes.
Which are, of course, in UFO lore, kind of legendary figures on Giant Rock. George Van Tassel, George Adamski, and George Stevenson?
No.
Williamson.
No.
Williamson.
Wilkinson.
I knew it had to do with a sword. All right. Remember the Wilkinson sword commercials?
And now you've got me all messed up. I can't even, George Hunt Williamson. George.
The three Georges. That's good enough. All right.
Okay.
You remember that?
You know who I mean.
You remember George, the Wilkinson sword commercials for razor blades?
No, I don't.
Not you, George. You don't shape. George, remember?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Shaves as sharp as a Wilkinson sword or something like that. I can't remember. All right. So we've talked about the three Georges. I guess those were kind of the good old golden days of ufology in a way. They were a lot of fun for everybody.
It was always busy at her house and always one or the other or somebody was there giving talks. And
now, this is Dr. Mack's house.
Yep, Dr.
And this
Mack's
is in,
house
is this
in Turlock,
not in
California.
Turlock, California, which is not terribly far from Fresno. It's in that area. I guess you're on the San Joaquin Valley. Okay, so we've gone through that the last time you were on the program. Now, where we want to go tonight is this issue of the alleged ghost of Nikola Tesla.
Now, I didn't call him a ghost, Jeff.
All right, what did you call him?
I just said he appeared. He was as real as any human you've ever seen, just like Valiant Thor.
Well, ghosts do manifest, according to people who have seen them, three-dimensional. You can walk up and touch them. They do that. So
okay.
Whatever he was.
All right. You call him whatever you want, I guess.
So the presence of Nikola Tesla came to you. Where were you? What were you doing? And why do you think he chose you?
Well, I have to give you a little preface here.
Uh-huh.
There were three or four things that led up to this. One was one morning I was introduced to living waters, like the Bible talks about living water, and what that was all about and how special it was. And so I wrote up a whole thing about living waters. And then after the living waters came in, I was given a hypothesis. Would you like me to read it to you?
Yeah, please.
The energy of creation at the center of all known and unknown quanta is only reached through the creative structure of hydrogen and its vapors. Thus, water becomes the starter for this demonstrable leap in energy, and through the balance of its ingredients to a harmonic completion, we reach the unified field and produce a fusion-type energy source. Now, that was the second thing that came in.
Mm-hmm.
Then one day I walked into my office, and there's a formula bouncing around in my office.
How so?
It was a ghost of a formula, I should say.
Real ghost. Okay. So there was this, what color was it?
It was just I don't even know. It was just bouncing around.
So you actually saw letters?
I ignored it because...
You saw, wait. Now, you saw letters and numbers and a formula.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it was
small. It's not very large, okay?
Uh-huh. And it was in your office. All right.
And it's bouncing around, and I say, okay, when you want me to know what it is, let me know. And I would walk out of my office and come back in, and this thing would be bouncing around again and twirling and doing all kinds of little hat tricks, okay? And so about a week later, I went, well, I've got to figure this out. So I sat down and tried to figure it out. And
did you write it down as it was moving?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's S equals HO3.
All right. S okay. equals HO3. All right. And the S
yeah.
being?
That's, and so I sit down. And
what does the S stand for, Judy? Do you know?
Spirit.
Okay.
I think. I mean, that's what I had to work out. Jeff,
okay.
I had to think about this.
All right.
I knew about the hydrogen and the oxygen because I'd been introduced to living water. So I was pretty sure that if we were talking hydrogen and oxygen, we were talking spirit. So the bottom line is I finally worked it out, and I was pretty comfortable with what I'd worked out. And then I got a call from a friend in California who was a spiritual friend, and she had inoperable breast cancer, and she said, can I come to you? And I said, absolutely, get here as fast as you can. And so while we were waiting for her to come from California to Montana, in the corner of my eye, I would see this funny little man. But if I tried to look at him, he would disappear. And he looked old-fashioned, what I could tell, and so I said, okay, when you decide what it is you want me to know, let me know. Well, just before my friend was going to arrive, I went out on the deck, and I was praying, and I had my eyes closed, and off to the right, I could feel some movement, and I opened my eyes, and there he stood, and it's a funny-looking man. He's in an old-fashioned suit. His hair's combed old-fashioned. He's got a bowler hat in his hands, and he kind of bends forward, not bowing, but just kind of in respect, kind of bows forward a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and he says, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Nikola Tesla. And if I knew then what you now know, this is what I would have built. And he points to the place up in space, and a big circle appears, and I'm seeing this like movie of how to mix it, what the ingredients are, everything about it. And then smaller circles come forward, and it shows me, those would show me what this would do for the planet, how it would save the planet, basically.
Is this SE equals HO3, or is this something different now we're into?
No, this is something different.
Okay,
now hold on. The next step.
If I can, I need a picture in my mind. You're on your deck. It's daytime, nighttime.
Daytime.
Okay, and you opened your eyes and you looked to your right, and a man is standing there. This man is 3D, appears to be 100% corpulent, solid.
Yes.
Standing about, how tall? He was tall?
Oh, I don't know, maybe 5'10", something
okay.
like that.
Average?
I mean, you know, when a man appears to you like that, you're really not looking at that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, and now when he spoke to you, did he speak telepathically, or was it verbal?
No, it was verbal. It was verbal.
How would you describe his voice? European accent? American
no.
accent? Neutral?
I don't think there was an accent. You know, where, I don't know. I concentrate on the important stuff, I guess. That was more important to me, what he was saying and the pictures that he was showing me. And, of course, I was very startled. Had mm-hmm. no clue, but then I knew that it was the person I'd been seeing in the periphery of my vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I still didn't know what I was going to do with this. And of course, I had my friend coming, and
now
so
he's,
I had
excuse
to be
me,
ready
Judy,
for that.
he's standing there, and you stood up, I assume. And
no, I was still sitting there.
Still sitting. He pointed up in the sky, and a circle area in the sky was showing you what? What are you seeing in that circle?
The mixing of the energy and how much hydrogen, how much oxygen. There were like two cones coming up, a cone on the top, a round sphere in the center that was see-through, and a cone on the bottom, which was one was the top and bottom, hydrogen, oxygen. And in the center, as this all came in to the center, then, and it was mixing, you could tell it was moving. Then after it was all mixed, there was this golden glow around the outside edge of this see-through sphere. And so I went, oh, it's a golden energy machine. And so that's how it got the name Gem.
Okay. So it's a kind of looks like a glass ball in a way. And,
yeah, it's just a sphere.
And the things
but
that were
basically
being...
Basically, what he was showing me is how to mix it. It wasn't that that was what I was supposed to
okay.
build.
And
it was...
Wait. How are you? Are you pouring ingredients into this sphere? Are you?
Yeah,
how are they being added?
He's showing me that it had a spout on the top,
okay.
and I could see it going in, and with water, of course, because it starts with water. So, yeah.
And he's
it's,
describing
that's all
to
this
you.
Energy is water, hydrogen, and oxygen. That's it.
Uh-huh.
That's all there is.
Is he describing it to you as he's doing it? Like I've
no,
put
it
this
was
in
pretty
here.
Explicit.
He just said he just pointed and you watched.
Right. Numbers appeared. I will tell you that numbers appeared, so I knew amounts.
Okay. Were you able to write this down, or were they instantly memorized?
No, it was pretty obvious because I had worked through up to that point. That's why he said, if I knew then what you now know. See, I wasn't looking for energy. No, this was not what I was doing. I would have never gone this direction if Tesla hadn't grabbed me and said, come this direction because you know the right stuff.
Hmm. And then what happened when the demonstration was over?
I was in shock.
He just vanished?
Oh, yeah. He backed away. And when he wasn't standing there when he was showing me those pictures, as the first center circle, the big circle, was showing me how it mixes, he disappeared off to the side. Yeah, he was gone. And then I watched the smaller ones come forward, and, for instance, all the water was pure. Cars didn't have tires. They were flying in the air. I saw a spaceship just gently going out into orbit, not blasting out. I saw
in the circle
computer.
Or in your mind's eye? In the circle?
No, these were in the circles, like a movie.
Okay.
Like a movie. I saw a computer that had no keyboard. It was attached to your head, and your every thought entered into the computer. What else? Oh, I saw greenhouses full of healthy food that now in a greenhouse you could feed an entire city because of the production and the healthfulness of the food. I can't think of them all right now, Jeff, but
Now, when you first saw him and you turned to your right, did you make eye contact?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh,
what happened when you made eye contact?
Nothing, because he just said what he had to say and backed away. He was all business. There was no, like, interaction.
No cosmic
like
this or that. He was just giving you a message.
Yep. And the interesting thing, Jeff, this in 1984, 86, something like that, I was living in California at the time, and I used to go over to a psychic in San Jose because I had a stepdaughter who had Ewing sarcoma, and I was trying to get more information about that, and so I would go over to see her. And so I went this one time, and she starts the reading, and then she said, "Judy, do you know who Nikola Tesla is?" And I said, "Well, of course." She said, "He has information for you." And I said, okay. I want her to just get back to her reading. And then pretty soon she'd say, "Judy, you need to read his book, A Man Out of Time." I said, okay. And then pretty soon she'll go, "Judy, this is big. What he has for you is big. It is really big." And I put that completely out of my mind. I had no thought about it whatsoever when this happened. It wasn't until later I went, "Oh, my gosh, I wonder if that recording is still out there in the barn." So I went looking, and it had been ruined. I had it, but it had been ruined by the rain.
How long before you saw him was this reading, approximately?
Okay, well, the reading was in the 80s, middle 80s, mm-hmm. and my experience was in 1994, so that was probably 6 or 7 years later, something like that.
That was the year I started this program. Interesting.
Is it?
Yeah. So
wow.
I've
been at this 21 years almost.
Yeah. Well, we started our 22nd year in June. This was in Montana.
Yes.
On the deck. And so
on the deck.
What did you do with the information that he gave you, and how did it relate to the formula that was flitting about your office?
Well, when it all came together, and it's in the hydrogen cipher, you'll see it. I'll send it to you. I should have sent it to you before, but I didn't know how. So I'll send you a PDF of the hydrogen cipher.
Well, we're linking to your name, judybeebe.com. So it's all there on your page.
But the one thing I do want you to link to is the new site, which is gemspheres.com, because we're now making these available. So personal spheres, so for everyone. So they need to know that, because I'm going to go on here and tell you why it's so important. So I worked on this for many years, okay, Jeff, trying to get people's attention. We spoke with the Michael McCubry, Dr. Michael McCubry of Cold Fusion fame, spoke with Dr. Hal Pudoff.
You yourself talked to Hal and Dr. The other one?
Yeah, all of these people, okay? And so finally, we got together, and we went to a physicist in Michigan, and I think I sent you that graph, that second round over unity graph.
I didn't get it. No, and if Frank can... See, it has to come from a computer that's in my address book, so maybe Frank has
it. I'll send it to you, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and well, it shows that we were doing it by strictly all scientific ways, you know, and he had calculated how much the amount of hydrogen and oxygen we were using, and at what point it would combust, and what it would take to combust, etc. And the average over unity was... for three tests running for 7 days was, well, I don't know the average, 1,680%, 1,650%, and 700% for three tests running 7 days. That's
and
over unity.
This test was performed by whom, Judy?
I'm not going to give his name.
Okay, that's all right. But
he is a physicist in Michigan.
Okay, Hal Pudoff is right up at the top there. Now, what did he think of all this?
Well, why don't you ask me what I thought?
What did you think?
Well, Dr. Hal Pudoff was given the formula, literally, after signing an NDA, given the formula, and he couldn't figure it out, and decided he wouldn't test it if he couldn't figure the formula out.
Huh.
And it's the simplest thing in the world. It is so simple that anyone can figure it out.
Hold on, if you would, Judy. Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back in a few minutes with George and Frank and Judy and all of you good people as we do something a little different tonight. And we'll hear more of the story as we continue, so don't go away.